Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
This podcast is part of the How We Are Network. For information on this episode and many other like-minded shows, visit howweare.org. That's howweare.org.
What's up, everybody, and welcome to another episode of 100 Words or Less, the podcast. I'm your host, Ray Harkins. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate all of you who are downloading the show. I know sometimes I forget to say that in other episodes, but honestly, this is an amazing journey. There are a ton of other podcasts out there. There are a ton of other things you could be spending your time doing, but you are hanging out with me, with us, with my guest, and that's awesome. I really appreciate that. Anyways, the guest this week is Mr. Matt Miller. He is a professional photographer as well as a veteran of the hardcore and punk scene. He used to play in a band called Most Precious Blood. And I'll just go ahead and say it. He is literally my favorite photographer around right now. He does weddings. And that is where he makes his money. That is his bread and butter, so to speak. And the way that he captures weddings are just unbelievable. Because like, you hear wedding photographer and you like want to fall asleep. Like, I mean, no one is looking forward to shots of a wedding or someone else's wedding, but you can pop onto his site, wearediamondeyes.com, and you can see the life, the love, like everything that a wedding is supposed to inspire. And it's just completely poured over the page, over the print, over the website, whatever you want to call it. And anyways, I'll go on about Matt in a minute. Let's get some business out of the way. So I'm fundraising right now. There's a cool website called Patreon, patreon.com. And what they do is they offer an awesome service. It's kind of like a Kickstarter, except there's no time frame on it. So what I'm coming to you, the listener, is I need some money. I want some money to pay my editor, to buy better recording equipment, basically to afford this show more of an opportunity to make this even more professional, because let's be honest, this show is super professional, and that's sarcasm, to make this more professional. And so, like I said, I'm coming to you, the listener, for that help. Visit patreon.com/xpurposex, which is my online avatar for pretty much everything I've ever done in my entire life. So I figured it's not broken. It also combines the sort of, like I said, the Kickstarter element and the fact that there are rewards. So certain people are able to contribute X amount of dollars. So say you contribute $20 a month. That will turn into some cool rewards. And I even have rewards where I will do an episode on you, with you. I will hang out. We will converse. We will discuss your life. And I will be curious. I mean, I'm already curious about people to begin with. But needless to say, there's a bunch of fun stuff. So I'll be pushing this pretty heavily for the next month. So if you listen to the show, I look at it like this. When you go to a live musical event, you're paying like what? 10, 15, sometimes 20 bucks to do this thing, to experience it for, you know, maybe 3-4 hours. All I am asking for you, $2 a month. How about you do that? So that's like what? 50 cents an episode? That's a pretty small amount. So, and honestly, out of the thousands of people that download this show, if like just a fraction of you people decide to contribute, for one, I am humbled when people donate money. And for two, it costs you virtually nothing. If you do what? $2 a month? That's $24 a year. I've been doing this for over 2 years and I've been doing it for free. I'm not going to change that. I'm going to continue to do that whether or not you donate. But if you do donate, you are becoming invested in this show and invested in independent culture in ways that, you know, honestly, other people aren't. And that's fine. But like I said, I'm pleading. My hat is in my hand. I'm saying, hey, put some shekels in here. Thank you very much. Anyways, enough of that pitch. I'm really excited to introduce someone new to the show. I've tried to bring friends on in the past to do recommendations for music, and it's been hit or miss as far as like their own schedules, my schedules. Now I am on point. I'd like to introduce to you Mr. David Anthony. He is a writer. I think his official title is like head digital manager, something like that. But he works for an amazing website called the AV Club. And basically, that's like my favorite pop culture destination. It covers music, movies, TV, anything you care about from a pop culture perspective, they're covering in a very unique voice, in a way that you feel like you're kind of hanging out with all the people at this particular site. And it's something I really trust. If I want to see a movie, I pop on there. I'm like, oh, they gave it a B+. Looks like it's worth my time. So anyways, Dave Anthony, I got in discussions with because he mentioned this very podcast on that website a few times. And I was just like, holy shit, like this is unbelievable. And I even saw little spikes as far as downloads are concerned anytime that site mentioned this podcast. So anyways, what I wanted to do was bring Dave on to talk about some records. And that's exactly what we're going to do right now. After we're done with that, I'll tell you about Matt. Here's Dave. Let's talk some records. Let's talk about the records you want to talk about.
The two records I picked were the Hotelier full length, Home Like No Places There that Tiny Engines put out, which came out earlier this year. And I was immediately taken with it in a strange way because I was never a big fan of the Hotelier when that was their band name. Like I always thought they were good, but just didn't really hit for me. And I think Tiny Engines has, over the past 2 or 3 years, really established themselves as, in my opinion, one of the best labels that's around, just putting out, you know, really vibrant, vital releases by a lot of young bands and really taking risks. A couple of years ago when they did like the Dikembe LP and like Signals Midwest, Everyone Everywhere, like those are some of my favorite, you know, young new bands. So whenever they pick someone up or work with someone, I usually pay attention, you know, so I wasn't big on the Hotelier. And then this record came out and it just immediately floored me. You know, people have been talking a lot about emo and all that over the last couple of years. And I guess you could say it falls into that realm, but they just kind of have this like punk edge to them. Like there's not a lot of like, you know, noodling intricate guitars. It's a lot more straightforward and from the gut. And the lyrics are a lot more political. And that really resonated with me because it felt that, you know, there was this band who's been around for a long time and was kind of, you know, I guess always running alongside these other bands, and they finally, you know, made their huge statement. And I got to see them live a couple months back and they were just so tight and the songs really hit again and felt fresh. Like I was in this period where I was listening to the record almost every day and felt I was going to burn myself out, which I'm always nervous about doing when I get into new stuff.
Right.
And, seeing them play just started that whole cycle over again. Just, you know, the lyrics resonated and, you know, it was just this uproarious experience. You know, they're singing about politics and suicide and loss and all these things, but, you know, the room just felt tied together. It's like we were all going through this experience together.
Yeah.
And by the end of the show, it's like we all came out the other side together. And that's that's a record that I think is really important. And it was great to see, you know, Pitchfork review it and give it such a high grade, and so many places pick up on it. And I just hope people by the end of the year don't forget about it.
Yeah, no, it's always hard. Yeah, when you have those records that come out in January or February, it's like, can I remember that? Like, your average person that's not like you or I that keeps a running list going on.
Like, yeah.
And some people are just like, oh, did that record come out? Yeah, I'm definitely along the same lines as you, where it's like, I didn't really, honestly, I maybe listened to one or two songs of The Hotel Year when they put stuff up, Mightier Than the Sword. But
yeah.
Yeah, like it's funny because I always have to sort of compartmentalize bands in my own head before I can like move on. I mean, not move on, but just be able to appropriately look at them through the right lens. And so for me, just because these dudes are from like outside the Boston area, I immediately liken them to a band like Piebald. But obviously, as you illustrated, lyrically is way more serious, but has that element of I guess fun that's incorporated, because it's like they kind of throw everything in a blender and that kind of comes out to what they sound like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think Piebald is a great reference point that like I've never really hit on, and that's kind of why I love talking about like records like this, where I have this very defined formulated opinion. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, oh, it's like Piebald, and I'm like, oh shit, yeah, it is. Okay. Just Piebald.
Yeah, no, it's totally, yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly, where it's like when you just look at it through a little different prism, it really does kind of open up a whole, you know, new can of worms. But yeah, I really like the record too. When you just start to see and feel like, you know, I definitely come at it from a perspective of where, just because I do sort of work, you know, behind the scenes of a lot of stuff at record labels, you start to hear people talking about them from an industry perspective of like, oh, dude, this guy picked him up for like a booking agency. And oh, yeah, man, all these labels are talking to him. And it's like, once you start to hear that, you know that there's something on the horizon for them. Like, not even just like from an industry standpoint, but like they're going to be out there for a while because they have all these people interested in them.
It's one of those things where it's like, I think a lot of people don't understand that side of the industry. And for me, it's really, you know, because I get to see parts of that and, you know, with totally. Who's writing about them and, you know, even just like who is premiering the track or streaming the album, yada, 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 yada. But like, for me, that's the most exciting thing, is because I love seeing a band that I'm obsessed with and, you know, or is doing something in the scene I care about and comes from, you know, similar-ish backgrounds, getting press for doing what, you know, this community's always done. That's really important. And my entire goal has always been to like champion things that, you know, I'm excited about and I think are important, because, you know, I want to show someone their new favorite band. And it's not because I'm so great, but it's just, I understand there's an audience out there that might not get to it any other way. And it's cool when you see a band like them who is around forever under a slightly different name, make this change, kind of, I wouldn't say redefine themselves, but finally figure out what they were always trying to do, and then, you know, blow up from it, and rightly so. And it's just great to see that people outside of punk and hardcore and indie and emo and in this bigger realm are starting to take knowledge of this stuff that people have been doing for so long.
It's heartening.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, yeah. And what was the other, I don't even call it an album, but, you know, a demo for all intent and purposes.
Well, yeah. And I feel super pretentious, like picking like, oh, it's the band's demo on cassette. But I picked the band's demo on cassette. It's a band called Earth Girls, who are one of my favorite young Chicago bands going now. It's members of a lot of other bands. The singer Liz was originally from Boston, played in Libyans, moved here, started playing with a band called Broken Prayer, who are, in my opinion, one of the best Chicago hardcore bands going. They just have their very own unique sound. She plays keys in that band, and it gives it a weird, like, very angry, exploding Devo kind of sound. And they're just really, really fucking cool. But this is her singing and playing guitar. Joey Capel, who's in Boilerman and in Broken Prayer, plays bass. Vincent Aguilar, who's in Please and Thank Yous and the Valentines, plays second guitar. I don't know what their drummer does because I'm an asshole, but that's most everyone else's resume. But a friend of mine, a guy playing a band with, he hit me up. This was probably like back in February, and he's like, hey, there's a show happening. I think they're playing with Radiator Hospital, who are another fantastic band. But he hit me up. He was like, yeah, it's their first show. I ended up not making it, but like they put out the demo and I found the Bandcamp link and I was just obsessed with it, just super taken with it. And it's just this great like garagey pop punk kind of sound. They remind me a lot musically of a lot of the stuff that was coming out of Texas, you know, even now, but more so like 10 years ago with bands like the Marked Men and OBM3s and a lot of that kind of stuff where it's just very straightforward and driving, but super hooky. And it, right now, like Chicago the past week has had our first stretch of good weather for the first time in like 8 months. You know, it's crack 60. So like we're all out wearing shorts and having a time. And like that's just been my soundtrack to that experience. The second song, 14 Years, is to me just like this beautifully crafted. And it's a total pop song. It reminds me of something you would hear like come on a jukebox in the 60s, just with like the way Liz sings and everything about it. And it's just five songs that are just like no bullshit and just kind of come out of the gate, you know, and rip through and are just so tight. And for what's happening, you know, a lot in the city, so unique because it either skews like towards super hardcore or, you know, emo-y weirdo kind of stuff. So it's cool to see a band just like be like, all right, no, like we're a pop punk band and we're going to be really, really good at being a pop punk band.
Right, right. Yeah. No, I was completely unaware of this until you sent it to me. And it was I mean, all those descriptors are totally perfect. And it's one of those things where I'm so bad at streaming stuff online to like actually dedicate my time to it, even though I do sit in front of a computer all day. And so it was, I listened to it about two or three times and it was like, all right, I got it. I'm ready for more. Like I had already digested it and I had already been like moved forward with it. So that's, which is a good thing in a certain, to a certain extent, but you know, it's, it does. I mean, and obviously it is shorter. I mean, it's like what, 10 minutes long, if that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a super short EP. I know Grave Mistake is putting on a 7-inch for them sometime in the near future, which I'm really excited about. But, I saw them play 2 or 3 weeks ago at a house here called 86 Mets. And, like they were the first of three, and just were absolutely mind blowing. Like there were maybe 15, 20 people there and they just were so energetic and just so good. And it just, you know, really indentured me to them because, you know, it's cool to be able to see a band like that who relatively quickly has gotten, you know, I wouldn't say a lot of hype outside of the Chicago metro region, but, you know, are getting on bigger shows, opening up for bands like Swear In Here and Radioactivity, which is members of the Marked Men. So they're quickly kind of, you know, finding their audience. And that's really cool to see. And I think they do great things both in this band and with what else they do. So because it's so good, that relieved my anxieties about picking something that would make me sound like, oh, well, you don't have the tape, man. So I'm glad you were cool about that.
Yeah, no, it's you do always run that risk of like, oh yeah, just the first 7-inch was the best, everything else is terrible. And it's like, you don't want to be that guy. But
that's totally a product of being someone who's like really into music, you know, just always running the risk of being like, they're like, oh well, did you hear the demo? Well, the demo's the best. And like, sometimes it is, but I love hearing a band in that really raw early gestational stage and then being like, holy shit, like I cannot wait until they put out a full length. I can't wait until they put out a 7-inch. I can't, you know, and kind of following and growing with them, which is something that I think is very important to this culture and community and scene and scenes or what have you. And it's just something that, you know, when I find a band, even if it's just, you know, the first song they've ever put out, if it's a good song, I'll tell all my friends about it, you know, and try and convince them to go to a show and hope that they continue down that path. And if not, cool. Well, you wrote a cool song. That's right. Better than most of us.
Well, those are two great recommendations and I'll include the links in the show notes that I will put up on the website. So I appreciate your time, Dave. Thank you very much for your first contribution.
Cool. Thanks for having me, Ray. It's been a pleasure.
So yes, hopefully you enjoy that from Dave. We'll be doing that probably about once a month, so look forward to it. And thank you, Dave, for contributing and being a fan of the show. So like I said, Matt Miller, I love his photos. They're incredible. I love the medium of photography. And he was gracious enough to drive down to my house after a photo retreat in Southern California. I just loved hanging out with him, loved talking with him, has a great perspective on where he sits at in his own profession, where he's had to adapt in his own life, and just so many cool things for, you know, I wouldn't say tips and tricks, but basically just things for you to take into your life, learn from his mistakes or his experiences, and basically build cool stuff on your own. Because essentially, that's what I want you to do as just a inspirational person who likes to make things as well. Did I just define myself as inspirational? That came off wrong. Regardless, you get my point. So let's just get to it. Here's Matt. I'll talk to you afterwards.
First introduction to you. I mean, it was weird because it was one of those things. I've been aware of you prior to our first interaction. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if you remember our first interaction.
But, where was that?
Well, because we've never met. But yeah. First interaction over email.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Was when I hit you up about that Terror layout.
Yep.
Setting up the story where it's like Terror. I mean, they basically turned in that record completed to me when I was working at Century Media. You know, I mean, being a hardcore kid, like you just see whatever you see live photos and you're just like, oh, like okay, like someone did something. Yeah. And then I can't remember if you hit up Century Media, just like the info at centurymedia.com or whatever, but it was brought to the attention where it was like, hey, that's my photo in there.
Yeah.
And it was like, because typically those sort of requests, they don't go unheard, but it's one of those things where it's kind of like, who is this person sitting? But then once I saw your name, I was like, oh, he clearly Matt should be taken care of. And so that he was one of those things I was scared to be like, oh shit, I don't know how this is gonna work. Like, is Matt gonna be super pissed? Like, how is this gonna work? And then, like, because obviously it's not gonna come back on Terror.
Yeah,
it's gonna go back on me. So, but you were, and fortunately you were awesome. It was super easy to deal with, and it was like that just made, not like I had a negative impression of you going into it, but it was one of those things where it was like, oh, you're reasonable. Like, because some, it's weird because some people, they're one way when it comes to just how they are as people, but then you put just like even a little business in there.
Yeah, and it gets weird.
And they just, they're like, you've changed.
Yeah.
Like, and but yeah, you're very consistent, so good job.
Yeah, I remember that. Photography is what I do for a living.
Yeah.
And it's almost 100% wedding photography. I still do like some portrait stuff and
of
some,
course.
Some music stuff. But I don't really make a lot of income from music stuff just because I know the money's not there.
Of course. Well, but, live photography, like, I mean, that's hard to be like, yo, this is what I do, and like I get paid for layouts. Yeah. Like, not very many people do that.
Yeah. And I definitely don't need to charge for it because it's usually my friends and whatever. But literally the only reason I charge, like if I see something in a layout or on a t-shirt and I hit somebody up.
So reasonable.
But the reason I do it is for the photographer behind me. It's like the kid who's just starting out and actually needs money to buy another lens or to fucking buy a CF card or something like that.
Yeah,
if I'm giving all my images away for free, I'm setting a precedent that the guy behind me who's just starting out and is like, oh, I guess this guy, everyone before me gave away their images free. I guess I will. And then he's burned out and broke and shoots all the time and then he's screwed. So.
Right. In my experience within independent music, I've always believed that it's like no one should feel guilty about getting paid for stuff.
Yeah.
And that's always the stigma that gets attached to independent music and punk and hardcore. Where it's like, oh, dude, no. It's cool. It's cool. Everything's free or everything's like, you know, $4 or whatever.
Yeah.
I believe there's this middle ground of like, okay, I know you're not going to charge me a premium price. I know, like, in writing you, I'm like, I know that Matt's probably not going to be like, yo, dude, I need like $1,500 for this photo.
Yeah.
But at this on the complete flip side, it's not going to be that like, oh, that was cool, right?
Yeah, totally. And so you got to find that weird middle ground.
Right, find that middle ground of like, you need to be compensated for this, but at the same time, like, you know, it can't swing that other direction where it's like, oh, man, because then you're not a human. You're just like a corporation where you're just putting stuff into you. And it's like, oh, here's my output. And
totally, yeah.
It is weird. But I was glad that interaction did go another way where it was like, oh, man, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to bum you out. I didn't do anything, but I'm going to have to be like the vehicle for that.
Totally.
Born and raised. Were you always East Coast? I had no idea where you
Yeah, I was actually born in upstate New York.
Okay.
And then 6 months later, my parents moved to Atlanta.
So you had roots in Atlanta. Okay.
Oh, yeah. So I grew up in Atlanta, and then, you know, that's where I got into punk and hardcore and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then put on shows and whatnot, and then eventually moved to Brooklyn in 99, I think.
Sure.
I had played in punk bands in Atlanta and stuff like that. It's a funny story. So I moved to Brooklyn. I was kind of like the new guy.
Yeah, they're all of a sudden like, who's that guy coming to the show?
Well, I knew a lot of people. Like, sure. I ended up moving in with Tommy from Silent Majority. He was like my favorite hardcore band. And they would play Atlanta, and I would book the shows, and they would stay with me and stuff. And then I was like, oh, I want to move to New York. He's like, oh, fuck, we need a roommate. I was like, oh, perfect. My life's going to be a Silent Majority song. It's going to rule. Like, every day we're going to go to the beach and, like, high five and fucking stage dive and stuff.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different things that stress us out, right? Like, maybe it's something really, really small, like, man, that parking space, it's always taken. And I wish that I would be able to, like, get it instead of, you know, this person that maybe, you know, is the most courteous and considerate. I know that's something very random, but it's true. We all experience different things throughout the day that trigger us in so many different ways. And there are many times where I have been like, I wish that I had a spot or a repository for me to, you know, get this stuff off of my chest. Because if you bottle it up, that is no bueno. And then all of a sudden you explode on a coworker or a friend or a family member being like, the parking spot. And people are like, what are you talking about? That is where therapy comes in. And I love working with BetterHelp because I'm a huge advocate for therapy, broadly speaking. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, please give BetterHelp a try. It is so easy because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire, and then you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you are not vibing with the therapist for any reason, you can switch it out at no additional charge. Get things off of your chest with BetterHelp. So visit BetterHelp.com/Ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/Ray.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
And I moved there and I fucking hated it. I hated
it. Immediately. How old were you at that point?
I was just turned 20.
20, okay, 20. Yeah.
The circle of friends that I knew there were like, oh, this is Matt. He used to play in bands down there, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And, you know, I needed a job. I needed, you know, some sort of connections or whatever. And people were like, oh, well, shit. And I got offered to be in 3 different bands within being there a week. I got offered to be... Silent Majority broke up like 2 days after I moved there. Like I lived in a room off the kitchen.
Okay.
There was like, I guess, a dining room. Right. But it literally had a curtain.
Curtain, yeah.
And I had like a futon mattress on the floor.
Sure.
And Tommy just opens it up one day. He's like, yo, Silent Majority just broke up, and closed it. I was like, motherfucker. Like, I already hate Long Island. And then your band breaks up. God damn it.
Yeah, you're like, that was the whole reason.
So Tommy comes in and is like, hey, so Silent Majority breaks up. I'm going to start this new band called Blood Red.
Blood Red, that's right. I remember that.
And I heard the demo and it didn't sound like Silent Majority.
No.
So I was like, I don't know. And then... I knew Justin and Rachel from Indecision. We used to book Indecision shows in Atlanta all the time.
Right.
And they had started Most Precious Blood. I had the demo and I fucking loved it.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to Justin, or one of them, and they're like, "Oh, Rachel had played bass at the time. She was like really wanted to play guitar again, so they need a bass player." And I was like, "Well, fuck it, I kind of know how to play bass if I know how to play guitar. I'm not a terrible guitar player. I'm a terrible bass player.
Right.
I'm just fun to be around. So luckily, I get to
Which a bass player is like the perfect role.
Yeah.
For that, where it's just
I don't
like,
really know what I'm doing. I can monkey see, monkey do all day, and I can drive a van. So fuck it.
Right. And I'm generally good to be around.
And then the girl that I was dating at the time, this girl Julie, was like, she was friends with this dude Eddie Reyes, who was like in the movie Life, and he was in Mind Over Matter and stuff like that.
Right.
He had started this new band, and they were kicking out their singer, and their bass player was going to start singing, so they needed a bass player.
Sure.
So I remember sitting in the car with Julie and being like, "Fuck, this is like I really want to play. I haven't played music in like 2 years. My band had broken up in Atlanta."
Right.
And I was like, "What do you think I should do?" She's like, "Well, whatever you do, don't join Eddie's band because they won't go anywhere."
Right.
And then that band was Taking Back Sunday, and I was like, so anytime I see her, I was like, remember that fucking great career match you gave me?
Yeah, remember that fork in the road where I went down because of you? Yeah.
Sure, thanks.
You're like, whoops about that.
Yeah. No, but I ended up joining Most Precious Blood and then playing bass for them, and it was obviously I wouldn't change that for anything.
Oh, no, for sure. And so the formative, I mean, basically your formative years you spent in, well, why did they move to Atlanta? Why did your parents move to Atlanta?
My dad had a sweet job in the packaging industry.
Okay.
So he... I guess they
was
make,
he was in the
they
pack.
Make boxes in Atlanta, and we actually lived in Atlanta for a while, and then we moved to Birmingham, Alabama, Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and then back to Atlanta.
Okay.
So
Why were you born in New York?
That's where they were born. My parents were born and raised in upstate New York. That's
okay. I see what you're saying.
So then just shortly after I was born, we moved down south.
Got it.
So, then we moved back to Atlanta when I was in second grade from Alabama.
Okay.
So that's where
and that's where it all and everything happened. And you have a brother, right?
Yep. I have a brother and a half sister. My half sister got disowned when she was 18 and I was like 5 or 6 and no one will tell me why. Some shit had to have gone down.
Wow.
But like I'll ask my mom, she won't tell me, and bro's like, it's better off you don't know. So I literally have no idea what happened. I know she was a shithead, but I don't know.
Like to what extent?
Yeah, to what extent to like getting kicked out of the family?
Right, to be like no one's going to speak of you or about why you're not speaking to anybody. That's crazy. That's crazy that that wall got put up around that.
Well, I remember one thing did happen was she wrote a letter to my mom and was saying that she was getting married.
Okay.
So then my mom sent her wedding dress, my mom's wedding dress, and money. And then apparently a month later, she found out that was just a lie. She was
a ruse. Yeah. Getting some money and get a wedding dress. I guess. Yeah.
So apparently she is a shithead. So.
Right. That's not a move that people would do.
Yeah.
That are good.
Not good people. Yeah. But yeah, I have a brother. He's 2.5 years older.
Okay.
And he's computer guy. And then he actually just opened a vegan bakery in Atlanta.
Amazing. He's in Atlanta. Still.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And so how would you describe your familial life, as it were? Was it good growing up? Like, did you guys have, I'm sure every family has problems.
My parents are awesome. They never fight. They're still together. They were very hands-off, though.
Yeah.
Like, full on, my dad worked all the time and was always out of town for, like, business meetings and stuff like that.
Sure.
And then my mom was just, work 9 to 5, come home.
Did she work in the packaging industry as well?
No, she did payroll for some.
Oh, sure, whatever, like clerical work and stuff. Yeah,
just nothing exciting or meaningful. Right. And then she would come home from work, and we had a living room and a den in our house. Me and my brother would hang out in the living room, and she would go to the den and literally put on soap operas and just watch those all night.
Wow!
And then
just you guys.
Yeah, we'd order pizza and just eat pizza, and I would go skate and like go to shows and stuff like that. As long as
It's like from the point of when you were probably like 10, 11, I mean, you were essentially just like watching yourselves.
Yeah,
like
there's, full on. Yeah,
right. You're like, would your mom be so hands off, or she was just like ask you where you're going, or was just like, oh, I'm doing this, mom? Like,
I would just but like I ran away a lot as a kid. Like if I ever got told I was doing something wrong, I'd like, fuck you, and just leave for like 3 or 4 days.
So like that's your first reaction?
Yeah, full on, just bolt.
Like immediately. Yeah. Not even like I'm not even hearing this.
Yeah, it was bad.
Yeah.
I was a pretty bad kid when I hit probably 14.
Okay.
So I was into skateboarding and punk rock
How'd you get intro to that though?
Because that's sixth grade. This dude named Eric Currier was in my. in my class, and he came in with his side of his head was shaved, and like denim jacket was some fucking bullshit all over it.
Right, right.
And we're bringing a skateboard to school.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just like, dude. Okay. The day I fell in love with skateboarding was I went with my parents to see David Copperfield in Atlanta.
Dude, fucking love David Copperfield.
So yeah, yeah. It was at this place called the Fox in Atlanta. It was downtown. Like, I would never go downtown. We lived in the burbs.
Okay.
And just dude skating down the street, like three or four kids, and just like all laying down a curb, and like shredding down the street.
And you're like, what are they
got? For like a second. And I was just like, fuck.
What
that's
is
it. That is it.
Yeah.
And we went to like, the VHS rental place down from my house, and I got like the Pal Peralta video, Public Domain.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And just watching that. And like, I had heard punk rock before, but then like seeing it with skateboarding, and I was like,
Those two together made so much sense. Separately?
Yeah. That's Ray Barbie's part, it was McRad.
Okay.
The song Weakness. Dude, it still gives me, even thinking about it gives me chills. But yeah, that's how I fell in love with all that. But then my first show ever was, there were these local bands. One was called Act of Faith, and the other one was Crisis Under Control.
Mm-hmm.
And I had like their demo tapes or whatever.
Sure.
And I was like, they're playing this show at this place called The Masquerade. And it ended up, they were opening up for GBH. So my first punk show is GBH and Act of Faith and Crisis Under Control.
Okay.
And dude, it was awesome.
Like, right.
People just going completely bananas. And there's a lot of people there for GBH. Like the local shows were a lot smaller, but like
sure.
Packed house, everyone was going bananas. Like my first stage dive happened that night, like all that stuff. Like
was it, full on. Did you find, was the stage dive executed properly? Were you?
I doubt it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure it seemed really cool in my head, but like I'm sure I just fell over and
right.
People someone like, punched me in the face and whatever. But there was, like, the gnarliest, full-on, like, the end of Outsiders brawl after the show.
Oh, jeez.
Like, skinheads versus, like, the hardcore kids.
Oh,
dude. And I had no, like, I had
no alliances. Yeah, you know, right.
And I was just like, then it was, like, grown-ass men punching each other in the face. But they were probably just, like, 19 years old or
something. Yeah,
But, like, full force beating the shit out of each other.
Right.
But it didn't scare me. Like, I was just like, whoa, that sucks. But, like,
right.
I
yeah,
would
you're
still
like,
go to shows.
Right, you're like, as long as I'm just watching this.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
But I just remember, my first 5 years going to hardcore shows, like it was like Nazis were there, like there was fights all the time and like all that shit.
Yeah, there was that, I mean, especially it's like, in the, in the 90s, there was such a schism where it's just like people, you felt like you had to take a side and that there was no understanding any other point of view.
Yeah.
I mean, not to say that like you need to understand a skinhead's point of view.
Yeah.
Clearly. Yeah. I think that's been proven.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's just those, even within like the factions of obviously like, straight edge, where it's like you had each person's dedication to it was questioned because of whatever they were doing. It's it's such a, and then now it's like just such a hodgepodge of like, oh, everybody's into it.
Yeah.
It's like, but at one point it was kind of weird how that was doing that.
Well, I got to see the transition from like everything was at clubs then,
Yeah. Yeah.
Like even the local shows. And then, us finding our own venues and making DIY venues and doing.
Sure.
There was a point for 2 years where it was just house shows. Like,
right.
Even like, One Away would play, it'd be in a fucking living room.
Totally. Stuff,
but it was awesome.
Well, because, I mean, a lot of those, because Atlanta, while it's a big city, it's still, you obviously compare it to like New York or LA, and it's like, it's smaller. But so it's like, I would imagine that, having a, solid all ages venue, that was like hard for that to sustain for a long period of time.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously now it's more established, but. It's like, you look at like Las Vegas and it's like all ages venue. It's like, forget about it.
Yeah.
Played a record store 1 year and then next year
it's gone. Yeah.
Why were you being a little shit? Like, were you just basically like, yo, I'm on my own. I'm doing this. Like,
I don't know. I compare it to, I have a 2.5 year old girl at home.
Right.
And I feel like she's starting to test it. Just saying no for no fucking,
totally.
I just don't want to eat.
Yeah.
It's like, you're fucking hungry. I know you're hungry.
Yeah.
But I think just testing boundaries. I got really into drugs when I was 14, 15 years old.
Just exposed to it through peers and stuff.
Yeah.
Shows just, and whatever. Yeah.
Well, not even shows. It was just fucking
skaters.
I just wanted to be weird. And,
yeah.
I guess the skate crew I hung out with was into it. Like, I did a lot of acid, smoked a lot of pot and stuff. And then my brother and I actually got put in rehab on Thanksgiving Day.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was pretty rad. Because we got really stoned and we were like,
okay.
Turkey, dude, it's going to be rad. And then my mom's like, oh, we got to go to the store to get something. And literally just kept driving. And I'm like,
whoa.
There we go. And then there we
go. And then that's, wow. So that was, and your brother was doing like that stuff with you? Or like you guys were completely separate on that? And your mom was like.
I remember getting my brother stoned for the first time. It was pretty amazing.
So you introduced your.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. But yeah, we had different sets of friends. Like I was more into skateboarding. He was like more like just long hair metal.
Oh, okay. Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, we would definitely get stoned a lot together and stuff.
Right.
But, we got put into rehab. We were away for 2.5 weeks, and then we had a outpatient thing for about a year.
Okay. So we had to like check in and stuff like that.
We had to go to AA and I had to have random drug testing, and then we had to do family therapy.
Yeah.
Did the family therapy people were saying that, you know, our unit wasn't tight enough, and that's why I was doing
right.
It was so stupid.
That, I mean, at that age, you don't have any perspective in general.
Yeah.
But like, did you feel like you had any like loss of control or anything like that?
You're that just, was like literally we'd have to like, so the crappiest thing was, is my brother and I are 2.5 years apart, and they wouldn't let us be in like the same unit together because they thought we would like start a gang and just fucking kill people. So I don't know.
Right.
But they literally had us, they had to have us separated, but they have you separated by age. So there's the adolescence, pre-adolescence, and whatever farther down the line.
Right.
So I had to be in the pre-adolescence while my brother was in the adolescence.
Okay.
So I was 15 at the time. And so I had, I think the cutoff age was 13 for the pre-adolescence. Okay. So I'm like way,
two years
doesn't seem like much now, but like then.
Yo,
like,
it's huge then,
So dude, I was with like kids who were like, I hear piano noises at night. My fucking dad touches me. Like just.
Real deep.
But like young kids who don't really know what's going on.
Of course.
And my brother's like with people with fucking tattoos already and fucking shaved head. Like, I would see them leaving lunch while I was going in. I'm like, he gets to hang out with the fucking cool, like, the punkers, man.
Hang out with... I identify with
that. I'm hanging out with kids that, like, wet the bed and, like, don't know how to fucking eat. Oh, God.
Right. Yeah, because it's like, you're looking at it from the perspective where it's like, you know, if you're going into this situation, obviously, against your will, but you're, you know, you didn't feel like... Your mom was obviously heading you off, where it's like, okay, clear, like, Something's wrong. And, like... The people that you were surrounded with, I'm sure, were obviously so much worse off as far as, like, they had been, you know, whatever. It had been long festering, those issues, where you're just kind of like, well, I was just dicking around for, like, fucking year, like, you know, doing stupid shit. And, so I could see where it was like, oh, my God, I'm in this weird middle ground.
Well, I just remember being like, you know, they would put us together in circles and be like, let's talk about our problems.
Right.
And they were asking me, like, you know. Why are you here? And I was like, I like to smoke pot. I love doing acid, like whatever. And they're like, why? I'm like, have you done it? It's amazing. Like, having fun. What the fuck is the matter with that? Like,
right.
You like watching football. I like getting stoned and eating potato chips. Like, what's the matter with that? You know?
Right.
So I literally had to like bullshit my way out of being in rehab. Which is like, I just feel alone, man. And just like, you know, yeah, like I told them what they wanted to hear, you know?
Totally. Hit every cliche. Yeah.
So literally got out. I think the only thing that got me to stop doing drugs was random drug testing. Like if I got caught with anything in my system within that year, I would be like put in juvenile or whatever. Like they had
an escalation. Yeah.
So I was like, fuck it. And then I remember the day I stopped doing drugs was I did a few like fucked up things while I was still under drug testing, like we're like huffing Freon and stuff like that at one point. So behind my parents' house, there's like a concrete slab that holds our air conditioning units.
Okay,
we get a trash bag. Open the Freon gate on the back of the thing.
Oh yeah,
and like fill up a trash bag. And me and these two dudes who are like sick boys, like the social distortion, like pompadours, white shirt tucked in. Those two dudes,
greasers, right?
Yeah. So we're just huffing Freon, too. So stupid. We're huffing Freon behind the house. And it makes your voice really deep when you do it. Like, it totally just destroys your brain and your out of your mind for, like, 20 seconds and then whatever. So my friend Glenn is doing it, and he, like, takes this huge hit of Freon, passes out, hits his head on the concrete slab.
Right.
And, like, it's all muddy back there. It just rain or whatever. And he gets back up, and he goes, I've never felt better. And it's, like, really deep. He's drooling. His eyes are glazed over. His head's bleeding, and he's covered in mud.
Right.
And I'm like, fuck it.
You're like,
this is just fucking stupid.
Where have I gone? Yeah. Why am I here? Yeah,
this isn't fun. This is just fucking pathetic.
That was one of the, it's a sobering moment.
Yeah.
Where it's like, especially if you have any sort of insight where it's like, oh, this is where my life could go.
Yeah.
It's not going to go anywhere good.
Yeah. I was having a great day before we got here.
Right.
Like, why didn't I just continue doing that? Why am I hanging out behind my house?
Right.
Fucking
trying to
poisoning
find...
my brain and watch it just drool on each other.
It's totally. Totally. Yeah. Trying to find, because, I mean, that, when you're doing stuff like that, that's definitely like, you're becoming more creative for a high. You know, you're like, oh, how about we do this thing?
Yeah.
How about we do this thing that clearly is like the worst thing possible for us? As opposed to like, oh yeah, here's your standard fair drugs. Like, no, let's go to Freon.
Yeah.
But it shows you're creative too.
Yeah.
I presume because of all of that, you like could give two shits about school.
Yeah. It took me 5.5 years. I actually graduated high school.
Okay.
I graduated in summer school.
Okay.
In a lunchroom with like 14 other losers.
Sure.
It was so sad.
Yeah.
like all my friends were there, and like, you know, they're like Jim Johnson, and be like, his two parents in the back, like in a fold out chair or whatever.
Oh no.
And then they call my name, and like my friends like printed out streamers and like threw like, it was so funny. But yeah, I was I remember my first year of high school, and you know, just two semesters. First semester I passed PE.
Okay.
And nothing else. Sure. And then the second semester I passed art, and then nothing else. So I failed my first ninth grade year.
Okay.
And then every other year was just fucking skimming by.
Yeah.
I didn't give a shit about school. I didn't care about anything they were teaching me. Like,
you're like,
I
there's nothing relevant in here.
All I cared about was skating and going to shows and stuff.
And so at that point, I mean, so once you actually graduated, is that when you obviously started to be like, did playing in a band, was that like a thing you had to do? Or was that something that was just obviously a byproduct of what you were surrounded by?
I just said earlier, I'm not a good musician. I don't know music theory. I can't fucking, I don't know anything about, but you know, I can write a 5-chord punk song, you know,
like
I learned how to play 3 chords when I first, like I took 1 music class when I first got a guitar and a guy taught me how to play like Hotel California or something. So I know like the couple chords that are in that, and I'm like, all right, fuck it. And I was like, what's a power chord? And he showed me how to do that, and I was like, all right, I'm done.
Yeah,
and then never took anything else.
Give me the basics.
Yeah. And then just learned how to play, you know, Minor Threat and Sex Pistols songs and stuff, and then, you know, started the band a week after that. So
when what was your first band that you actually played a show in?
We were called One Way.
Okay.
And, how old was I when I started that? Probably when I got out of rehab, 16 years old.
Okay.
Was my first band.
Sure.
Or
stylistically, what were you trying to go for?
It's just really bad youth crew.
I was going to make that an inference, but I was like, it could go another way. So
it's the simplest to play. Like,
of course.
Metalcore, they're at least getting a little bit, you know, pinch harmonics and shit. I didn't know how to do that.
Ah, cool. Yeah. Perfect.
So, you know, I listened to, like, Instead was, like, probably my favorite. And that's, I just ripped all that shit off.
Right. You're like, how can I rearrange this to sound?
Fast breakdown. Got it. Cool. Got it. So I did that band for a couple of years. Like, we actually did two tours.
Oh, wow.
That's terrible.
Like, I mean, East, like,
just went out to East Coast, played like 5 shows, but
still,
like in Vermont or something like that.
Still, yeah.
But it was cool. It was fun. And like, people I met on that tour are
still friends of the day.
I still run into.
That's the one thing that I always find so. It's like when people tell me that they have like the touring experience, like on the level that obviously both you and I have had, it's just, I nothing makes me happier. Cause it's like, you find people that you're still in touch with, you know, whatever, 15 years later.
Yeah.
And you're just like, and some of those are the most smallest and inconsequential. Like, oh, I remember meeting you in fucking New Hampshire at this awful show and 5 people.
Yeah.
And you were one of those people, and we are still friends. That's insane.
Yeah. That was Pete, bass player from Bane, had like some terrible fucking metalcore band.
Yeah.
We literally, my band played.
Right.
And then we gave them our instruments, and then they played, and we literally played for each other. We were the only people at the show, just looking at each other. Just, this
good
is
job.
So dumb.
Yeah. Right. This is, what are we here for?
Yeah.
How far did we drive?
Yeah.
Oh,
so
no.
Stupid.
But yeah, you don't ask yourself those questions.
And then this is probably 97.
Okay.
96 or 97. And then playing shows with some terrible band in North Carolina, and ended up being the guys that ended up being in the first step. And
It was
just like so weird, and we're all still friends. And
totally, it's such a cool experience.
Yeah.
So obviously, by the time you graduated high school, I'm sure you just be like, all right, I guess I'll just find some jobs and just kind of hang out and like just
worked at health food stores.
Okay,
like, no ambition, just
piecing stuff together.
Yeah, just working at a burrito place, didn't matter. I made enough money to eat and
just play,
skate, and buy a couple records, and that was it. You
know? right.
We had a warehouse we all lived in Atlanta. Had like a 4-foot half pipe in it. Did chairs out of it. Like, built our rooms inside it and stuff.
Was that where like Ezra and all those dudes from the?
They lived across, like, there. It was like a train trestle that went in between. It was where trains used to come from.
Yeah,
and just drop off stuff in the warehouses. So they're like you open my front door and you're looking at their front door. They're like
just,
right across from us.
When I toured with those dudes, it was just one of those things when they were describing to me, and like, not only where they lived, but obviously like the scene that was in Atlanta. It was such a, I was like, you guys are living. I'm like, that sounds amazing. Like, especially for the sort of like, you know, creative impulses that can be expressed in like, oh, we're in a warehouse. You can fucking paint. You can do graffiti. You can skate. Like.
Yeah.
And it was just, sure it was awesome.
It was awesome until, like,
yeah.
Well, there's so much space in a warehouse.
Yes.
There's one bathroom.
Yes.
So we had 6 people that were paying rent.
Sure.
And then
a lot of other people.
We had a ramp.
Right.
And then we had like a loft area above like three of the bedrooms. It was just like 20 couches up there.
Sure, sure.
Whatever. And everyone was reading those Crime Think books at the time, which is like super inspirational.
Totally.
Not very practical.
Dumpster diving. Yeah, yeah.
And so everyone was like, yeah, dude, we're not fucking, we're going to be off the grid.
Yep.
So everyone stayed at my house and ate everything out of my refrigerator.
Yeah.
Was taking my clothes out of my washer and dryer that I brought there and would just like throw it on the floor because they had to wash their clothes.
Sure.
And like just.
Yeah.
It's just mooching off everything. Like
totally.
We only paid like $100 rent there.
Right, right.
But so like, fuck you. Like.
Totally.
I know you're.
I know what you're doing. Right.
You're keeping it real, but you're piggybacking off me.
Totally.
And not making it cool. Like
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Literally pissing me off. So I was like,
of course.
I had to like. Kick like 10 people out of the house.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, that's you mix that sort of youthful idealism with the practicalities of like being a pre-adult. Like,
yeah.
It just all starts to crash, and it's like, oh, wait a minute. Like, maybe I can not do all of these things, and I'll still be productive.
Yeah.
So when did you start to feel the I guess, the more creative urge to like, I mean, what actually inspired you besides a space in New York City to actually move up there? Or was it just
a girl?
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, yeah, yeah.
I had this idea to write a book a long time ago.
Okay.
Which
never materialized. You still have a draft of it somewhere or anything?
I have really bad notes written down. So basically what I wanted to do was just leave Atlanta.
Okay.
And travel and, you know, same crime thing. Like,
sure.
What are you going to like,
train hop and stuff like that?
I was going to train hop. I was going to go in my car and just like barter for food at restaurants and stuff like that. Like wash dishes and,
yeah,
and
yeah,
trade
yeah.
for food and like try and lose the identity I had from when I was a kid until then.
Sure.
And then I did that in the winter, so it was like I got like 5 days into it, and it was like snowing. I was like, "Fuck it, I'm just gonna start like cold calling friends, being like, you know, I had a friend in New Jersey, and
right.
then he has a friend in Boston, and blah mm-hmm. blah blah." And I actually stayed and met tons of new people and met like a whole series of friends.
Sure.
But during that, I met this girl Julie, and that's who I moved to New York for.
Okay, got it. Yeah. So yeah, there was an anchor you could throw up to that was
yeah.
like, okay, that's where I'm going to go.
I was living in the warehouse, and you know everything was just fucking frustrating.
Right.
And
so you're like, I need a change.
I need something different. And right. I was like, New York sounds cool. Like
right.
whatever. And I moved there. And my fantasy of New York was New York City, not Long Island.
No,
Long Island. So I got to Long Island. I was like, this is just one big mini mall. It's like the burbs of Atlanta.
Yeah.
But 90 times more expensive and frustrating to get around.
Oh, dude, forget. Yeah. Like, yeah. Long Island Expressway. It's
yeah.
You're just like, hell. Like,
just awful. Yeah.
Just
to get to anything cool. And like, I was coming from Atlanta where literally every kid was vegan straight edge.
Yeah.
And like. We had shows in my house, and I had a ramp that was like I opened the door to my room, and there was a half pipe right there.
Right.
And all we did was skate and eat burritos and fucking drink soda and like just to be jackasses.
Right.
And I moved to Long Island, and everyone ate at Chili's.
Right.
No one was even vegetarian. Just,
yeah.
It just sucked.
It was like such a cultural removal from what you've
yeah.
been used to.
I was in Fantasyland, and I moved there, and I was like, wow, life sucks.
Right,
pretty
right.
bad. I was working at. This dude Nick, who's in Bayside now,
oh sure, yeah,
was the manager at a Abercrombie and Fitch kids store. So he got me a job folding T-shirts. So that was my job in New York. Was I folded shirts for children at Abercrombie and Fitch?
Oh my god! Yeah, yeah.
I was fucking.
I was about to say miserable. That's kind of lowest low.
Yeah. So then once I started talking to Justin and Rachel, joined the band.
Uh-huh.
Moved to Brooklyn.
I mean, obviously, like you said, you still had an inkling that you wanted to play music, but did you, like, was it your desire that, like, yo, I want to link up with someone to tour and, like,
yeah,
do that?
Yeah, that's
okay.
all I wanted to do.
Got it.
I have no burning desire to, like, create
sure.
musical geniusness.
Right,
I know
right,
that's
right.
just not going to happen. But
sure.
I love touring. I love hardcore. I love meeting people.
Right.
I love just...
The whole experience that's
yeah,
wrapped up
all
in it.
That. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And then it's another thing. It's like I had nothing else...
Right.
I wanted to do. Nothing was calling me. I didn't want to be a dentist. I didn't want to fucking
yeah, yeah.
do anything.
Right.
I just wanted to be
a
dude.
Right. The packaging community wasn't.
Yeah,
wasn't
I was good. I saw my parents and I was like, that sucks. Let's find something else.
let's do something else.
Yeah.
Those Precious Blood. You know, you guys went. The thing that always blew my mind about the drive of the band was the fact that it was like, even though you guys were, for all intent and purposes, like a full time band from
yeah.
a touring perspective. Is that it never necessarily felt like it from the standpoint of like, it felt like this was a vehicle for you guys to just like travel and do weird shit.
Pretty much. I mean, for me,
from
yes.
your perspective, yeah.
I wasn't the driving force behind any of
right,
that.
Right.
So I don't know, like, you know,
It just seemed like
the big overall scheme of everything was, but that's all I wanted.
Because at that point too, it was that weird, you know, early 2000s where it was kind of like you started to see bands in the community be able to like quote unquote make a living, you know, where it was like, oh, like maybe I didn't need to get a job in between this like month off between your, you know, whatever. Yeah. But it never felt like Most Precious Blood was like there. I'm sure there were elements of that discussion in there, but there was never like where it's like, okay, here's the fucking business plan.
Yeah, never. And we, I mean. When sound scans became a thing and like marketing packets and stuff like that, we're like, what the fuck is this?
This is
stupid.
Totally.
We never gave a shit about any of that because we knew that wasn't us. That wasn't going to be, we weren't going to be a fucking household name. We weren't going to
have poison posters.
We weren't going to be signing posters after the show or anything like that. No one gave a shit about that, you know?
right.
We were just angry kids that wanted to play music and fucking have some sort of outlet for it and travel and fucking get weird.
You know? Right. I mean, photography obviously started to consume you as you were in the band. Like, you started to try, I mean, like, not consume you, but you started to experiment with it when you were in the band, right?
Yeah. I failed out of photography class in high school.
It's perfect.
Yeah. First I failed out of it.
Yeah.
And then I took it again.
Okay.
And then I got kicked out of it because my art teacher was a fucking asshole.
Sure.
And just had it out for me.
Right.
And we had some photo project. And I did it and turned it in. Mm-hmm. And then she's going over things. In front of the class was like, well, Matt got a zero because he didn't turn it in. And I was like, what? Like, stood up and was like, yo, I turned this in. She's like, no, you didn't.
Right.
And, like, got in a full-on, like, argument. And I called her a fucking bitch.
Yeah.
and then I got kicked out of class.
Yeah.
And apparently, like, 3 days later, she's, like, sorting something on her desk. I was like, oh, there's Matt's thing. And, like, threw it away. And I was like, fuck.
You're like, cool.
So I got kicked out of photography class and got put in marriage and family class.
Oh, that's like home ec, right?
No, this is like for full on like pregnant girls.
Oh, pregnant girl, yeah.
And it was the saddest thing ever, but literally the best class I've ever taken because I learned how to balance a checkbook.
Right.
I knew how to like
practical stuff,
real life shit.
right.
It was the only class I stayed awake for in high school.
Totally, you're like
kind of awesome.
Oh, I've heard my parents talk about that, so I should probably pay attention to this.
Budget, okay, rent, gotcha.
Yeah.
So I actually learned a lot in that class.
That's amazing.
How I got into photography was I have a really bad memory.
Yeah.
And I want to blame it on doing a lot of drugs as a kid.
Sure.
I don't know if I just had a bad memory. Who knows?
Right.
But like the first time we were going to Europe, that was like a big deal. And I thought, you know, at the time I was like, this is the only time I'm going to Europe. And
we were
touring with Madball.
Sure.
And I was like, there's going to be some
awesome happening. Yeah.
Yeah.
I got to document this.
It was the very first time we ever were in a bus too.
Okay.
So I was like, yeah, I got to fucking hook it up. So I got my first DSLR, which is like Canon Rebels, like silver and like the kit lens and whatever. No idea how to use it. Didn't understand. Like, I didn't know what millimeters were for on a lens. Like, if you told me, like, a 50-millimeter lens, I had literally no idea what you're talking about. And I had a 2-gig memory card. Okay. So I shot everything on small JPEG. So.
Oh, of course, because you can fit more in there.
Yeah, totally. So I did the entire, like, every tour we went on would fit on one 2-gig card. So literally everything I shot is, like, fucking this.
Like, right, like a postage stamp.
Oh, my God, it's so bad. Mistake learned, or lesson learned.
Right.
But it was rad because I would shoot stuff during the day
mm-hmm.
and then just lay in my bunk at night and look through the photos on my camera.
Right.
And be like, wow, these suck. Like, what did I do wrong?
Right.
And then I had
the
manual for it right there. So I'd like
cross-reference
the manual and be like, oh, shit. Oh, that's why this thing.
Right.
As being a tourist and walking around and taking a photo of every single old-looking church for no reason, you know?
Sure.
I was learning how to take photos and compose and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I just fell in love with it. It was awesome.
I experimented with photography as most hardcore kids do, like in high school, I was like the yearbook photographer. Yeah. And so just started to experiment with all that. But it changed my perspective of like the way you see the world.
Yeah.
Like, of like, oh, that would be a good photo. Like, and a lot of people, like, everyone, obviously, and especially in this day and age, views themselves as a photographer.
Yeah.
Like, clearly, because everybody has it.
Absolutely.
Amazing camera in their phone. But it matters. Like, people take pictures to obviously remember. But the distinction that I've always seen where it's just like, if you see a photo.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, you know what I'm saying. You're a photographer. But it's just like that switch goes off in you where it's like, oh, now I see how that should be captured.
Yeah.
As opposed to just like, oh, yeah, fucking shoot it over there. Yeah, that's fine. I just need to remember that. But it's just, it's cool that you had that obviously experience of just like, learning from the manual and by practice.
It was cool. It was cool to learn on my own and not take a class and not have to do any of that. All of my favorite musicians, like all of like the art that I really love, none of that stuff is classically trained. It's like, so, you kind of figure out the rules or whatever, like how to do the shit.
Right.
But then like you just figure it, like you totally. Just get weird with it and then something right. comes out of it, you know?
Right. You just suck at it for yeah. a long time.
What you're saying about the way you view the world, that zine I gave you a minute ago.
Yeah.
I saw Ian MacKay speak in when I lived in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a Q&A at NYU.
Sure.
And he comes out and he's just taking questions from the crowd. The first question came out was, what came first, punk rock or skateboarding? And then he talked about it for like 45 minutes. And I was bawling my eyes out in the crowd. Because, you know, I love skateboarding. It was my entire world. I mean, still, I just built ramp in my garage at my house like last right. week. But I never, you know, I could never pinpoint what it was that
identified,
made it click for me or whatever. And he was talking about like the first time he got a skateboard and like went skating and like changed his world. Like he didn't see his town didn't look the same to him anymore.
No,
like
you're looking at here's curves,
a set of, it's like a set of stairs. Like everyone's like, oh, this is what I walk up and down. It's like, no, dude, I could like ollie down these things, shred down it, and there's like a curb and I look at that embankment and like,
yep.
He said he would like ride in the back of his mom's car and just like look out the window and just imagine like riding a skateboard as the car is going along. Like everything that happened to me as a kid, just like you just imagine like skating down the curb and then, oh, there's this. And
yeah. You know,
like
it informs the way that you view not only the world just like from like a, you know, new agey hippie standpoint, but just like a practical, like this is now how I structure my world.
Totally.
Yeah. And so when Most Precious Blood started to, you know, wind down, you guys obviously didn't want to tour anymore because it's a grind after a long time. Yeah. Was it difficult for you to kind of wrap your head around the idea of like, oh shit, this is coming to a stop. Like I need to transition out of this somehow.
I call it the sick of it all syndrome. That I fucking love Sick of It All. I still think they're the best hardcore band ever. It's still put on a great show.
Yep.
But we tour with them a lot.
Oh, yeah.
You guys, a lot of them. Yeah. So I can remember as a kid, venues that they would play in Atlanta and surround, like if they would play North Carolina, I'd drive to North Carolina to go see them.
Right.
So there's this, I can't remember the name of the venue. There's a venue in North Carolina, like Tremont Music Hall.
Yeah.
So they packed that big room. It was Sick of It All, Strife, Cast Iron Hike.
Oh, and spectacular show. Yeah.
Sub Zero.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Just packed house, banana show, like best thing I've ever seen. Fast forward however many years, we go back, we play the small room, and there's 13 people there.
Yeah.
And it's just like, fuck. And they have nothing else.
No. Because I worked with them at Century Media. Yeah. And it was one of those things that was so weird. Like, when we were talking about, like, you know, whatever, launching new records and stuff, it was always this really difficult conversation. I mean, fortunately, they're all obviously awesome dudes, and they do have a clear perspective. They're like, yeah, I know why we don't do fucking tours in the States, because it sucks balls. Yeah. We play in front of 13 people.
Yeah. But every time we would go with, like, over to Europe or whatever, and it'd just be like festivals.
Second coming of Christ.
Yeah. Amazing.
Totally.
And I'm like, fuck the U.S., man.
I know. Yeah. And it was so weird to be, because they were in that position where it's like, okay, we can't go on a support tour because they can't pay us enough in order for us to keep things going. But at the same time that if we do a headliner, it's going to suck because there's only going to be 100-150 kids in some of these places. And it was like, you get to that position where it's just like, well, we have to kind of make do with whatever hand we're dealt and wherever we're maybe going to sustain some sort of popularity. Yeah. It's rough.
Like when you make hardcore your life for that long.
Yeah.
Like once it starts to dry up a little bit, it's like, well, fuck.
Totally.
Like,
where do you go?
They're not going to take care of me anymore. It's like, you gave your life to this, and then it's like, I don't like the new record. Fuck you.
Totally.
It's just such a bummer.
Yeah, it's just, well, I mean, any entertainment or art obviously goes through that, but it's like, you do.
Everyone should know, like, you can't make a huge savings on being a hardcore band. Like, it's just not going to happen. Even the biggest hardcore bands.
Totally.
At the time.
Of course.
Like, once it's done, it's done. Like, you could be sitting pretty for, like, a hot second, but, like...
Yeah. You need to have... Yeah. It's so terrifying to see, you know, kids... I mean, the perpetual myth of, like, being in a band and how that will sustain you for years and years. Yeah. It's like, you gotta have some other something. And not even just from, like, a practical, but just, like, you probably care about something else besides, like, headbanging on stage, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, some people don't.
Well, I did. Yeah, I definitely didn't. I had no
idea. Right. So you hit that wall, and I'm sure it was terrifying.
Yeah. So we all decided like we weren't going to be a full time touring band. So we had two tours left. We had I think a European tour, and then we went to Australia one last time.
Sure.
So in between, I think before both of those tours, well, we had a conversation months before that, before booking that stuff, And I was like, well, fuck, I don't want to live in New York.
Right.
It's cool. It was cool when I was home for like a month at a time.
Yeah. And just pop in and pop out. Right.
Yeah. And I worked at some burrito place and in the Lower East Side and literally delivered burritos on my skateboard. Like it was the perfect in-betweeny job.
Yeah. Right.
And then, but I was like, fuck, I don't want to do that every day. And that's my existence. And just scrape by and pay Brooklyn rent.
You know? Totally.
Like, there's no, and I had no idea what I wanted to do. So it's like any idea that you have in New York City, like, oh, I'm going to be a fucking unicyclist that takes photos of naked people down the street. There's already 20 people doing that.
Totally. Yeah. There's a group down there.
Yeah. And they're already, they've saturated everything. You're not going to,
that's true.
So I was just like, it's just not going to happen. I was dating this girl, Danielle, who's a tattooer. And then anytime I would go visit Atlanta, she would tattoo my friends.
Okay.
And whatever. And then those two tattoos were getting seen around town. And she actually got a job offer from a shop in Atlanta. I was like, yo, if you ever want to move down. And I was like, well, huh. Atlanta's cheap.
Right.
I know everybody there.
I'm pretty familiar.
I'm sure I could find something to do there.
Right.
So we decided we're going to move back to Atlanta.
Okay.
I was going to move back to Atlanta. She's from New York. So we moved to Atlanta. And then right after we moved is when I went to Europe and Australia and then came back and was like, all right, it's time to find a job.
Right.
And it was the deepest depression I've ever hit.
Sure.
I was about to turn 30.
Right. Well, yeah.
Obviously don't have a college education. I don't have
any
skills. Right. I have literally nothing I want to do.
Right.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Nothing that sparked a passion.
Yeah, like you ask a five-year-old, like, hey, what do you want to be when you grow up? And they'll come up with 10,000 things.
Yeah.
And they ask my fucking dumb ass at 29, like, what do you want to do? I'm like, I don't know. I hate everything, you know?
Right.
But people are always like, oh, you take really good photos. You should make some money from doing
where
that.
Were you, where were people seeing the stuff? Like, just amongst friends, obviously.
I started a blog called The 5 Mile Grace. And that's when I started posting
stuff,
like
live
band photos.
Sure.
Photos from being on tour or whatever.
Okay.
So I was like, oh, I'll be a music photographer.
Yeah.
And then I try to get, you know, the movie life's coming through. Let me get some promo shots of them.
Right.
And then I would take some photos and then like talk to like their manager or something like that.
Sure.
And getting $50 was like pulling teeth.
Oh, dude.
And $50 would pay for like...
Yeah, yeah.
My, not even my water bill, you know?
Right,
like, what
right.
the fuck? Like, that's obviously not going to
right. This work. Is this isn't a replicable model. Yeah.
And those shoots would happen like once a month, maybe.
Yeah.
So it was like super weird and frustrating. I didn't know what to do. So first job I got in Atlanta was at a bong shop that my friend worked at.
Right.
And I was literally, I worked the graveyard shift from midnight until 7 in the morning. I got paid $6.50 an hour.
Sure.
And I was selling what was called incense burners, which basically people smoke meth out of.
Right, right, right.
So if you can imagine the people, number one, that buy meth smoking pipes. Things, those who buy meth smoking things at midnight to 7 a.m.
Yeah, yeah. Sketchiest of the sketchiest.
It was like weird old men bringing in girls that looked like they were fucking 15.
Oh,
and
God.
Be like, pick one out. And they buy, and it was just like,
yeah,
killing my
get,
soul.
Get me out of here.
Just like, sitting there, and it just smelled like fucking hookah tobacco and farts in there.
Like,
and it was like
this?
Purple carpet and black light shit everywhere. And I was like,
what is this?
Someone
life?
Fucking
is,
stabbed me in the eye.
Totally.
Like,
I'm
so sad.
Right.
And then I met this dude, Ray Jones, in Atlanta, who was from North Carolina, and he was a photographer.
Okay.
And he was doing a book called Faces of Straight Edge.
Oh, okay.
So he did a portrait series of people who were straight edge and what they did.
Right.
So I found out about that, and I was like, hey, if you ever need a hand, I'm a budding photographer, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, well, let me take your portrait. And he knew I collected old skateboards, so that was like his angle, was like to have all my like 80s and 90s skateboard collection and take a photo of me with it. And we became friends shortly after that. And then once his book got released, he actually got a job at New York Times. So he
based off that book,
not based off the book, but he was already a
documentary photographer. Okay, he's already talking. Okay, got it.
So, but like, you know, right around that time, he got the job. So he was moving to New York, and he was like, "Yo, if you need work, I assist a wedding photographer, and you could do that." And all I could think of was like, "How shitty."
Yeah, this
like,
is this.
Yeah, that's awful.
But it's
better than selling meth pipes.
To be fair,
yeah,
kind of a better environment.
Well. Dude, so the meth pipe store, it was so bad there that the owner was like this really fat, weird girl who was a crackhead. And
sampling the product.
Would just like have like 30 people in her entourage, and they would just come in and be like, and just like take all these shirts and like take all this merchandise, just barrel
clean
out. And
store
just go,
out.
Yeah, just go to like the strip club and just blow them. She had like a giant Hummer and was just like a piece of shit.
Right.
So basically she was running out of money, and when we would get paid, you had to run to the bank
to cash that check.
To cash the check, because like if someone else cashed their check before you, there would be no money in the account.
Right.
And I was the last to get paid because I was a new guy. So my checks were bouncing.
Yeah.
I wasn't getting paid, but I was still going into work because I literally had nothing else to do.
Sure.
It was so fucking
sad.
Dude,
that's...
So basically, they sold skateboards there too.
Yeah.
So I was stealing skateboards and bongs.
Right, to supplement,
to sell.
Oh my God.
So I could pay my rent. It was so fucking bad.
Yeah.
So Ray moves to New York.
Yeah.
Gets a job in New York Times. Offers me a job doing wedding photography. All I can think of is just like the scene in Big where he goes to like the party and eats the caviar and everyone's in like a zoot suit.
Yeah,
and just
it's the worst.
Like an that's all I can think of.
Well, you hear, I mean, this leads into when I first started to, you know, and I'm not even using this word lightly, become obsessed with your photography. it was when I was seeing your wedding photography, where it's one of those things where it's like, it feels like all the photos you take are staged, which they're clearly not, except obviously the ones that are clearly like posed and they're obviously have been, you know, staged from that perspective. But it like, I mean, there's life, there's, you know, love, you know, vibrancy, if that's even a word, but it jumped off the page. And it was one of those things where it's like, this is how it should look, as opposed to the common conception of a wedding photographer being like, it's just, I mean, on my wedding, it was one of those things where it's like, you know, my mother-in-law to like fucking yell at the wedding photographer to be like, don't take a picture of this at this particular one. It's just like, chill. Like, very few people have that like positive connotation of like, oh, wedding photographer, probably a shitty person that just is like, oh, I was going to walk around with Polaroids for like, you know, $15,000 or whatever. It's like so many negative connotations.
Yeah, I went into it thinking I was going to fucking hate it. It
right.
was like super bummed, but I needed, they were going to pay me like $50 or something like that.
$50. Right.
And I did it, and it was for Our Labor of Love. I had no idea who they were.
Right.
You know, that was before like wedding blogs were even like
a thing.
They
had
just started like, and I did it, and I was like, holy fuck. Like, it was like, not even looking back, not even that cool of a wedding, not even that cool of a couple.
Sure.
But it was completely different than what I thought it was going to be.
Right.
And I was like, fuck, this is actually pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And they had never met anyone like me before. Like, I'm a friendly guy, but I'm pretty outgoing and pretty silly. And
of course. You got tattoos. You're just like, what's up with that kid over there? For sure.
But they liked having me around. They saw I had a good work ethic. And they they brought me on to the next wedding and then the next wedding and then just kind of brought me on.
Yeah, it snowballed from there.
So I was a wedding assistant with them for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started shooting my own weddings outside. I was still assisting them, but I did maybe like 5 weddings the first year.
Right.
And then the next year they wanted me to come on like as an associate. So right. I actually shot under their name until this past year and actually just started.
Right. My own thing. Yeah. Right. Which I think it was like when you announced that you were, you know, separating your and doing your own Diamond Eyes, right?
Yeah.
Where it was one of those things where it's like it seemed, and honestly, in a lot of photography that you did in regards to weddings, like it, so much of it, not actually, I wouldn't say so much of it, all of it is informed by capturing, you know, live events. Like, yeah. I mean, in the way that, like, you not only you light it, but the way you frame it, like, it's just like, yeah, you could replace some of this with like kids jumping on each other to show. And it's like, it's such a, to me, it was one of those things where it's like, it's something that you never would have immediately put together. Like if someone was like, oh yeah, hardcore shows, wedding photography, there's probably some similar. Yeah,
for sure.
No one. But then when you see it in the context, especially through how you're presenting it, it's like, oh yeah, why the fuck did no one else do that before? Yeah. It's so weird.
I get asked a lot. Like, how do you get your approach? Like it looks different than everything we've seen, but I can't put my finger on it.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, I grew up taking photos of 5 dudes in a band.
Totally.
And now you've got 5 groomsmen. And, you know, there's a reception where they're throwing the groom in the air. Like, I grew up photographing people stage diving. Like, I know how I saw that. That's what I want to recreate.
Right.
You know? Now I know, you know, shutter speeds and how
of
to
course.
Do
all the camera lighting.
Yeah, I know all that shit. Yeah. But my eye is centered from what I saw growing up skateboarding. Like, just a portrait of a skateboarder or just like, when you like if you look through skateboarding magazine now, like you'll see like people bring out lights and shit like that.
Yeah.
And you have a cityscape and that skateboarder is like this bit like tiny on the page. But he's gotta stand out like in a whole sea of cars and buildings and all that
shit.
So
much noise, yeah.
And that's what I learned is like why was my eye drawn to that dude?
Right. How's he being pulled towards you when there's so much stuff that could be distracting you from whatever it is that you're obviously trying to... Yeah, it's like all you've done is like, you're just like, I'm creating an environment in which I could potentially catch the best photos. Yeah. And it's like, so many people don't even approach it like that. Where they're just like, I'll just work with this.
Yeah.
Like, this is fine. Yeah. Like, my sheer talent will pull this out of it.
Yeah, I can't do that. And I think my photography is driven by hatred, as weird as that sounds.
Yeah.
Because I'll look at so much stuff, I'm like, God, this is so fucking bad.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
And one of the best pieces of advice I ever got as a photographer was like, you need to look at your work and then photos that whatever field you're looking at, be it skateboarding or punk rock or fucking some cooking magazine or something like that. There's images in there that will make you stop and be like, wow, I fucking hate that photo. Totally. Or this photo is blowing my mind.
Right.
But you got to take a second and be like, why? Like, why is this photo even... Why did I even stop and look at this?
Yep.
But then, like, why is this...
Why is this inspiring reaction?
Yeah. Why is it making me feel something?
Yep.
And I took that all the way back to images that I would remember as a kid. Like, I would go through old Thrashers or whatever and be like, you know, I remember John Cardiel, like, skating under this thing and, like... That photo sticks out in my head, and like, what makes it? There's a photo that this dude Todd Swank skating under a bridge, and like, there's this crazy shadow, and like, just the lines in it are really cool. And it was like the cover of Transworld,
right?
And I remember that photo. Like after I had that talk with this photographer, I was like, huh, I should go back and check that stuff out and figure out why I love it,
right?
And it was this guy Jay Grant Britton took the photo, and I like went back and looked at it. And I was like, oh. And then like 3 weeks later, I took a photo, like a wedding photo. Completely inspired by it, and it's
sure.
like
you're like that's yeah you can yeah. pull from that world, and it's like that's what's so important. I mean, I think anybody that's involved in any creative art, it's like for one, you have to be a fan of the process, like because so many people, it's like, you know, at whatever level of success, like I mean that's inconsequential.
Yeah,
it's like you have to enjoy putting, like, getting inspiration, being able to put that and apply it to whatever it is that you're doing, because otherwise if you're just like if you're just looking at this, I need to become this. It's like, that's just a fool's errand, you know?
For sure.
There's two last things I wanted to hit on was, obviously, I have been involved in a subculture for a very long period of time. And obviously from, you know, I mean, weddings are not subculture.
Yeah.
Like, and so having, you know, marrying these two worlds, you having to work with clients that clearly have like, they have a context for you because clearly they're approaching you because they like the work. Has it been difficult for you to like work with people that have like no context for who you are as a person? Like, I mean, as far as like
it's why I put so much of myself out there.
Yeah.
So like on my website, like it full on like,
right.
Well, I used to just have a wedding portfolio. Yeah. It's like wedding and music.
Yeah.
So it's like,
I noticed that. Yeah.
So when you look at the wedding, it's like, oh, this is really pretty, blah, blah, blah. And then the music, oh, this dude's obviously not a typical wedding photographer.
Right, right.
And then I make sure like there's at least a photo of me that shows that yeah. I either have my hands tattooed or my neck tattooed or whatever. Right. Like you should know that.
Right. If this is going to bum you out.
Yeah. Don't hire me. A lot of my approach is weeding out the people I don't want. Yeah. I don't want to sit around and answer 10,000 emails a day.
Yeah.
Because I'm in someone's price range or they're near me or they just need a wedding photographer. That's fuck true. That guy. I want the person who is like, are you available this date? Yes. Shoot my wedding.
Yeah.
The thing I went to this weekend, it was like a bunch of photographers talking about all this stuff and managing their lives and how do you do it and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And there's people that get 200 emails a day. And then they'll answer those 200 emails.
Oh.
And then the next day, there's the response of those 200 emails
and then plus the next 200.
Yeah. And they're like, I spend hours and hours in email. I'm like, well, what the fuck?
Cut
like,
it off. Fuck yeah. That.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Find who you want to work for. Cater to them. And there shouldn't be that many of them. You mm-hmm. know? There's not that many hardcore kids getting married every weekend. There's not that many fucking tattooers. There's not that many, you know.
Right, right.
And those people that value wedding photography. There's plenty of those people getting married, but they're just like, fuck it. You know, I'll pay $300 for some asshole to show up with
a
paper flash and that's it. And that's fine. You don't have to have.
No.
But if your value's in photography, hopefully they'll be able to find me. Hopefully they'll be able to
Do
that thing. So that a huge thing for me is not appealing to everybody because mm-hmm. I don't want to work for those people. I did it in the very beginning. I would say yes to anything.
Yeah.
I got kicked out of a venue once because I didn't have a sport coat on. And I'm just like, well, fuck that.
Fuck this,
you know?
Right.
Like, and
there's nothing in me in this.
Yeah. There's no point in it. I'm not doing the clients a service. They're not getting 100% out of me because I'm not putting my heart into it because I'm annoyed and pissed, you know?
Of course.
And I feel like with portraiture and weddings and stuff like that, you being able to throw yourself into the photo a little bit mm-hmm. and then being able to let the person be themselves is huge. And if you're not comfortable, if you're just meeting your photographer that day, it's going to be weird.
Totally.
You know, if you have no common ground and I don't know anything about football, I don't know anything about baseball, I don't fucking watch.
Right.
Fucking.
Here's some champagne. I'm all right.
Yeah. I'm not going to talk to you about fucking Budweiser. We're not going to talk about. Fucking whatever dumb TV show is on. Like, I don't give a shit.
Right.
And I don't want to have to talk about that. Like,
right.
I don't want to have common ground with a common dude.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not saying I won't shoot the wedding.
Right. You're not.
If they're doing something. I'm not saying no to
everybody. You're not closed. Right. You're not closed off to that, but you're just like, you know what will potentially get the, you know, not only the best results for you from a selfish standpoint, but from like a client standpoint as well, where it's like, if we're firing on like these cylinders, we don't have to be the same person.
Yeah.
But as long as we got this,
yeah.
this will probably come out okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a huge power in saying no. Like there's a huge power in like, if someone's talking to me and it's just, I can tell it's not going to work out, they're going to be much happier with someone else. And I can hope that someone else is going to contact me and fill in that date. I'd rather not make money off this person if I'm not going to give them 100% of myself.
Totally. Yeah. No, I think those are important lessons for anybody. Yeah. Like I said, just that's in the creative arts, it's like, it's so easy to say, you know, the power of saying yes, but then there's so much tied up into saying yes, you're opening yourself up to things that you just may not be good at. Yeah. And of course you need to try it at some point, but you've done that.
Yeah.
Context of kids, because I mean, I'm 33 and I have, I think my son and your daughter are like months apart because my son, he'll be 3 in April.
Okay.
And so anyways, we have a very similar experience from that perspective. And so the context of you being, you know, married, family man, and having all of this wrapped up into being like, oh, like I'm from this whole weird thing that my parents clearly had no context for, you know, how does that sit in your head as far as just like, wow. Like, I'm being a dad, and, like, you know, you could have talked to me, whatever, you know, 7 years ago, and be like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like,
it definitely, you know, I was definitely the guy, like, fuck your, you know, two-story house and 2.5 kids and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
I was just, you know, obviously just someone full of angst, but I carry with me so much of everything about hardcore. I'm still vegan. I'm still straight edge.
Yep.
Everything. My wife's a tattooer. I'm a photographer. We both own our own businesses. Like, I learned so much from just DIY and like, no one's going to make what you want. You need to fucking do it.
Right.
You know? So that's exactly what I did. Like I was very lost for a very long time.
Yep.
And when I found photography, I was like, fuck, how can I make it happen?
Yeah.
Okay. End up making it happen. And now, like, I'm literally out on my own. It's super fucking scary and frightening. And
sure.
But I'm making a go at it, and I'm going to see how it works.
Right.
And then my wife opened up her own tattoo shop, like, in Atlanta, where she's not from. That's, like, super scary to do.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you got to hope the clientele is going to come in. And it's scary. But, like, I'm, like, raising a child in a world, hoping that I can better the world, you know?
Right,
like,
right.
Or raising her vegan. It's not one of those things, like, I'm holding a gun to her head and be like,
right,
you
right.
ever have cheeseburgers?
Yeah. Know? But, like, I'm disowning you.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. That's just silly. But... You know, I would love to think that she'll grow up a compassionate
right.
person who understands why things work the way they were.
Mm-hmm.
They work, and the world's pretty fucked up, but you have the ability to at least make a small dent in it, you know?
Of course. Yeah.
And that's what's important to me, not having a kid because you're supposed to have a kid, or, you know,
yeah.
living in a house because you're supposed to live in a house. Like,
right.
all this shit I came to on my own, and I couldn't be happier with it.
Yeah. That's such an important point, because it's like, I feel like, especially within the context of, you know, of punk and hardcore and everything like that, you rally against so many things for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But it's like the, you know, like you said, like, a house isn't bad.
Yeah.
A marriage isn't bad.
Yeah.
Like, these things that are institutions that are you know, thrown up against a wall and beaten in the context of many lyrics.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. It matters what you do with that thing. Where it's Absolutely. Like everything that you're hitting on is, like, so important. I think people, especially just from, like, when you're first getting into it and everything is, like, the most new and exciting thing. It's like, it's never going to be tempered when you're that age, because mm-hmm. you're everything's new and exciting. Fuck everything.
Yeah.
But then especially because, like, now that a lot of us have grown up in the context of this, there are people to be like, oh, I see what that person has done. And, like, they've totally not become, like, you know, a hollow shell of what they used to be, you know, yeah, like, there's totally. There's these train tracks where it's like, oh, if I don't go down the, you know, lawyer doctor path, but, oh, there's these other things that yeah. are kind of interesting. It's
well, like, there's, like, you know, with Facebook and stuff like that, yeah. you can catch up with people in high school, and there's people that, you know, girls I knew in high school that had a fucking bright orange Chelsea and wore Misfit shirts every day or whatever.
Right.
And now they're wearing, like, University of Georgia, like,
right,
hoodies
right.
and just like, what
wow.
the fuck happened?
Yeah, where did this go?
Just right. stopped caring, stopped. Just whatever's easy. What? We're,
of course.
We're watching football on Friday? Great.
Yeah, that's fine.
What we're going to do. What are you doing? Going to Buffalo Bills and...
Right.
Just like, goddamn, it. Just yeah. gave up, you know?
Right.
And I never want that to be me.
No, yeah. Like, well, I think the people like you and I who have that trigger in our head that's just yeah. been installed when we were, you know, whatever, 14, 15 years old, just yeah. like, I don't want to be like that. Like, that will... I mean, that's not going to go away.
Yeah. I hope so.
yeah. Atlanta continues to blow my mind in so many different ways, especially it's like, I mean, where it's at right now, as far as the, especially what you see in the independent artistic community. It's like every time I visited down there, it's always just been like, it always is vibrant. It goes in obviously waves,
mm-hmm.
but it's like, and now that there's so many creative things going on, I mean, like, obviously that I Believe in Atlanta
yeah.
project, and like, there's something that's so inherently unique about your city. It's probably difficult to express it in words.
Yeah.
I mean, why do you think that is? Like, I know it's just a huge question. It's just,
I think that's the birth of I Believe in Atlanta, is because no, I don't think anyone can fucking figure it out.
Yeah.
I've loved Atlanta. Like, I've literally been everywhere. Like,
right.
I've been to South Africa. I've been to Australia. I've been right. to fucking everywhere in the U.S. I've been.
Sure. You've seen
everywhere. It. I've right. seen it. I've right. tasted it. I've been to that place. I've stayed there. I've
right.
been to these restaurants. I've done all that shit. And I moved back to Atlanta.
Right.
And I can't put my finger on it.
Right.
I love it. It's my favorite place. It's fucking sketchy. Not an easy place to live. There's no fucking beach. There's no, right. like...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I'll go to... Like, I was just in...
Yeah, Santa Barbara.
And it was amazing. Like, there was just rocks and waves.
Right.
And
it's beautiful.
Lush greenery. Just, it was fucking awesome.
Right.
But I'm going to go home and be home, you know?
Right.
And I don't know what it... Like...
It's this weird... Honestly, it's this weird... The way I've observed it, it's this weird sort of, like... you know, Detroit-like pride of a city that obviously, I mean, has not fallen as hard of a times as Detroit has,
yeah.
where it's like, but Atlanta is obviously, it's been established for a...
It only burned down once, come on.
It's true. But yeah, it's like, it obviously has the historical context where it's like, yo, we've been through some shit.
Yeah.
But then it obviously is, but it has that sort of Detroit-like pride. But then it also reminds me of Austin in the sense of that, just that sort of like, yo, like... There's this really weird side. Like,
yeah.
you may think of Atlanta and think of, you know, sports and, you know, football and baseball and, you know, TBS and everything else.
Yeah.
But then it's like, and then Coca-Cola. But then there's this undercurrent of, like, we have a lot of artistic stuff happening down there.
Yeah. I mean, hip hop scene, like fucking Outkast, Ludacris.
It's
like,
true.
Huge hip hop scene, hardcore scene.
Yep.
Fucking Foundation, like Criminal Instinct. Like all these bands are coming out of there. And fucking great art, great food, great everything. And everyone shouts out Atlanta.
Yeah.
Like, I want to say probably every fucking Outkast song somehow has the word Atlanta in it, you know?
True, true.
That's why I love I Believe in Atlanta, is because it's everyone's take on it. Like, what do you love about Atlanta? And they'll take a photo and they'll put the hashtag on it, or
right.
wear the shirt or something. Everyone loves it, but everyone's got different reasons for it.
Totally.
And literally, I've realized why I love photography. I realized why I love skateboarding. I still don't fucking... I don't know why I love Atlanta, but I do.
Right, can't articulate it. Yeah. Well, and I think what's especially inspiring about that, you know, that project of I Believe in Atlanta is the fact that it's like, you know, people like myself who clearly don't live in Atlanta, and mm-hmm. I literally have no connection there besides the people I've met. I can look at that and I'd be like, that is something. Like yeah. that feels good, as opposed to just like, you know, a lot of communities, like there's no sense of that, you know.
Almost every band that comes through, like,
yeah.
And just being on tour, you know, when a band is going through the, hey, what's up, Tennessee,
Michigan,
you know,
right.
But when we come through Atlanta, they'll be like, this is our favorite fucking town to play.
Yeah.
And it's not that the show is huge. It's not that it's the craziest show there.
Right.
But everyone there has got heart. And everyone wears it on their sleeve. And everyone fucking cares.
Yeah.
It's just something.
I know.
It's amazing. I want to believe that it's selfish. Yeah. Like being punk and hardcore, whatever.
Yeah, of course.
That we really fucking nurtured it. Like when I first started going to shows, it was fucking skinheads. They were assholes. It was like fights every single show.
Right.
We literally
had to weed those people. Yeah.
Just fucking grab it and put it somewhere else, and had to fucking police our own scene for the longest time.
Right.
And we took great care in that. Like these dudes, this guy Jeff Jock, this dude Ken 2-4, like we booked shows and fucking cared about it and gave a shit if someone was being an asshole. Gave a shit if someone was being like a fucking sexist, racist asshole. Like we confront it.
Totally.
Get the fuck out of here. Like, you're not welcome. This is something we built.
Right.
This is art. Like, that's not gonna happen at some club. They don't give a shit. As long as you're buying beer, do whatever you want, you know?
Right.
We didn't stand for it. And I want to think that carried over to a pride of like, this place is different.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Sure. No, I mean, that's because all you can view is obviously the world that you've experienced it and the context in which you're able to build it. But I mean, I think that's like, that again is why obviously that I Believe in Atlanta project is so cool, because it's like each person is going to identify with something different.
Absolutely.
Even if they've come from the same place.
Yeah.
They're going to find something that is different than the way that you view it, the way that your wife views it, whoever.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah. There's a lot of pride from it. And like I said, like that's only me coming as a punk hardcore kid, but like.
Totally.
Every skater, like,
mm-hmm.
fucking, there's a Low Card, which is out of Atlanta, Stratosphere Skateboards. The guy who won fucking best skater of the year is Grant Taylor, like, lives in Atlanta. His father ran Stratosphere Skateboards since he skated for Schmidtstick in the fucking 70s. Like,
that's amazing.
Putting down their roots and fucking caring about the city. And literally, I don't know why,
but
it happens. And it's there.
There's a reason that people do it.
Yeah. What it is, don't know.
Yeah.
I back it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I really appreciate you hanging out.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
This is awesome. I'm psyched.
Yeah, me too. It's fun.
Pretty awesome, right? I get so lost. When you hear me make that noise, it's like the, I just get so lost for words when I really do respect someone's work so much. And Matt is exactly that person. So visit his website, wearediamondeyes.com, and find out about all the stuff he does. Great guy. Support his stuff. If you're getting married, check his stuff out. Visit 100wordspodcast.com. Visit propertyofzach.com. Next week, huge guest, Brianna Collins from Tiger's Jaw. Great episode. Sweetest girl of all time. Not of all time, but sweetest girl, because the sweetest girl of all time is my wife, you know? I kind of, not only do I have to say that, but I truly believe that. Anyways, until next week, be safe, everybody.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.